in this episode.
Quality every single time you step on the field, every time you step into your craft, when you have these two and you can understand how to manipulate them, you get quality.
Learn to perform. Practical lessons so that you can immediately learn to optimize your health, happiness, and performance. Welcome to another episode of Learn to Perform. I am your host, Braden Ostepchuk. I have been looking forward to this episode for a while because it is my chance to fangirl over today's guest, Kristen Holmes, the VP of Performance Science at Whoop. And for those who know me, Whoop is my go-to tool for human optimization that I talk about all the time because I truly believe that it is the world's most powerful fitness tracker and membership. And yes, I'm wearing it today, and I am in the green today as well. Anyways, at Whoop, Kristen drives thought leadership, leads research and case study development, creates educational content, and works directly with hundreds of the best tactical, professional, surgical, and NCAA athletes and teams in the world, helping them interpret Whoop data to optimize training, recovery, and sleep behavior. But Kristen does more than help mastermind Whoop. She's currently completing a PhD with a dissertation examining the impact of circadian alignment on resilience in high-stress environments. What's a high-stress environment, you ask? Well, she has a 1,000-person study on U.S. Army soldiers in Alaska, the Arctic Warfare Unit, funded by the Department of Defense, a study that will be replicated with two cohorts inside the medical field featuring surgeons. And her thesis advisor is none other than Dr. William von Hippel, and I hope I said that right because I'm not sure, who is the author of The Social Leap. But let's continue with her resume because it gets better. Kristen is one of the most decorated field hockey athletes and coaches of all time. Competing at the University of Iowa, she was a three-time All-American, two-time Big Ten Athlete of the Year while playing basketball, no less. She then went on to be a seven-year member of the U.S. national field hockey team and a legendary coach at Princeton. Her tenure at Princeton is what I would describe as a dynasty, winning 12 Ivy League titles in 13 seasons and a national championship in 2012. These days, instead of raising banners, she consults with the Sport Innovation Lab, Arena Labs, the Liminal Collective, and has been a guest lecturer and speaker at the University of Massachusetts and Harvard. Her specialty is helping individuals and teams use quantified physiological and psychological insights to accelerate learnings associated with self-regulation and performance optimization. But today, she decided to elevate her performance from Harvard lecture halls and hop on a Zoom call with me. But in all seriousness, Kristen, thank you so much for making some time to speak with me today.
Oh my goodness. It's my pleasure. Thank you for that intro. I'm blushing.
Did I get it all right? I'm usually good for at least one or two mistakes in these.
No, you got it.
Okay, good. Perfect. So now that I was able to do my whole monologue and kind of lay out your background and why you're such a great source to have on, I'd love to dive straight into the first thing I love to ask everyone is, what is your definition of performance? So this is literally your job, but everyone has kind of a different take. So what do you define as performance optimization?
I define performance as the capacity to intentionally behave at a level equal to your physical, mental, and emotional potential.
Wow, you had that nailed down.
I've been saying it for a decade and a half. So
okay, and could you just repeat that one more time just so we can really absorb that fully?
Yeah, the capacity to intentionally behave at a level equal to your physical, mental, and emotional potential.
Right, okay. And I think the key word that I'm not used to using or hearing is intentionally.
Yeah. And that's my whole thesis, you know, is that performance is largely a choice if you understand the factors, physiological and psychological factors that influence your ability to, you know, optimize your arousal levels, your attentional capacity or motivation, effective effort. You know, if you understand those factors and you can build an infrastructure, routines that that enable you to attend to those factors in an intentional way, you can literally choose your level of performance. And I've kind of been able to test this out, you know, as a coach for years and years. And then, you know, over the last 5 years at Whoop, just working, you know, with many of the best athletes in the world, you know, being able to really wrestle these factors to the ground and help folks understand how to build routines around it, understanding what to measure and monitor, you know, to stay on track and to recognize when you're getting off track. And, you know, again, it's, you know, we talk about this concept of flow. That's how you get to flow, right? It's not this magic moment where you're, you know, just all of a sudden, you know, optimizing your potential. It's a state that you can intentionally get to if you understand the factors that influence your performance levels. and really what I do on the applied side is take these principles and, you know, incorporate them into the infrastructure of these environments and help people understand, you know, how to work toward them, how to build them into their routines, again, what to measure, what to monitor, so they can really live the, you know, their best life and be the best version of themselves and, you know, achieve all the things that they want to in their life with as much joy and energy as they can.
Right. That's amazing. Yeah. And I love the way you kind of summarize that it is data-based, but I just want to, for a second, just to make sure that I'm clear on this. So when we're talking about the flow state, which is something that I've become more and more interested in lately, and the work of Stephen Kotler and a lot of other people in the field, but yeah. I know I, not officially or maybe not consciously, spent my whole life and my whole hockey career trying to achieve the flow state, because there are those few times you get that elusive state where yeah. it just clicks and you're just dialed in, whatever yeah. that may be. And trying to then reverse engineer how to get there, but without the resources, without the tools, and with limited knowledge for someone like me, or for probably most people who are in constant pursuit of that flow state, it is really hard then to figure out what are the triggers to get into that state. And so what you're basically saying is that, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, so you can confirm or deny this, that it is possible in many ways to reverse engineer flow state through physiology and psychology. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. So then that leads me into, I want to talk about Whoop, because this is where we can open the door to all of those different aspects. Whoop is in so many ways, I think it's groundbreaking, because you are now quantifying what for a long time was considered to be strictly subjective. When you yes. get to the elite levels of performance, because how could you quantify feeling in a flow state? But there are ways through physiology and through psychology. So I would love for you to give a rundown, especially for people who aren't familiar with Whoop, how that works, what some of the key metrics are, and why they're so important. And then we can really dive into certain areas after that as well.
Yeah, I think the principle that people need to grasp onto is that there's this concept of capacity, right? Like, we all come to the day, we wake up in the morning and we have a measure of capacity, right? Like, that's, and we at Whoop, we talk about this as your recovery level, right? Like, what, and we measure this on a scale of 0 to 100, loosely bucketed in green, yellow, red. Green means that your, you know, your system is primed to adapt to the stressors, you know, mentally, physically primed to adapt to stress. You know, in the yellow zone, that means you're good to go. Maybe not as primed as if, you know, you kind of ended up in the green bucket. And then red means you're not adapting in as functional a way as possible. This could be because you overdid training over the last couple of days, too much volume, too much intensity relative to your capacity. It could be you're underslept. It could mean you've had, you know, you're having relationship struggles, financial issues, you know, a fight with your kid, you know, so it could be a combination of psychological and physiological factors that influence your ability to recover and restore. And that's really what we measure in with Whoop recovery. And the inputs that we use to measure recovery are heart rate variability, resting heart rate, and we take these during your final five minutes of your last episode of sleep. So it's a pretty consistent measurement. It's when you're unconscious, you can influence these metrics. We look at your sleep performance, so how much sleep you needed, okay, per measured by Whoop, and how much you actually got. And then we also measure respiratory rate. So our algorithm basically takes those four inputs and mushes them together in an algorithm and gives you a status on how ready you are to take on load that day, both mental and physical. So when we talk about flow state, if we're trying to back into this concept of flow, you know, controlling for the factors that influence our capacity is really the North Star, right? If you're interested in performing consistently over time, you know, the whole, when I was coaching, I wasn't interested in just winning an Ivy League championship, you know, one time during my career. Like, I wanted my team to experience that every year, right? So how do you do that? Well, you understand the factors that influence capacity, your ability to show up every day to do your craft. If you understand the factors that influence your ability to show up every day to do your craft, then you have a choice. You can attend to those factors in an intentional way, right? And then influence your mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual kind of capacity and your mental, physical, emotional arousal. Or you can make choices that don't allow you to control that arousal state, right? So I think once you understand these factors, you build them into their infrastructure, you can then really mediate your ability to kind of show up with as much mental and physical capacity to do your craft at a level that feels like you're in this flow state.
Right. That's amazing. Now, I wanted to clarify on one thing, and this is something that I have perhaps struggled to wrap my head around myself. So when we talk about capacity, you are encompassing mental, physical, spiritual. So does that mean that our capacity then is derived from the ability of our nervous system to react and to respond to change? Because
yes,
from at least what I've tried to understand, is a lot of it is the big difference in our ability to adapt. And that's in many ways what HRV is. It's a measure of our ability to adapt between sympathetic and parasympathetic. So is that really the key, is we are priming our nervous system as the basis of human physiology to adapt to stress or any situation, any time, and therefore it allows us to perform. And it's kind of a equal potential to perform, whether that be physical reaction to stress, like I need to run away from a lion, or I had just had a big fight with my girlfriend, or I got a test or something. Is that kind of right, the way I'm looking at it?
100%. So yeah, you're kind of talking, what I'm talking about is kind of autonomic control, right? Like you want to have control over your autonomic nervous system, right? In order to control your response, so whether you're optimally able to, whether your heart can respond to the demand of the signal that, okay, I've got a lion chasing me, I need to run, or, I need to perform surgery and I need to decrease my heart rate to a point where I can execute, the surgery. Like you want to be able to, a prime system is one that can respond to the demands of the autonomic nervous system equally well. So your autonomic nervous system is going to be sending signals to the heart. And the more variability you have, the more responsive your heart will be to both signals of your autonomic nervous system. So parasympathetic is deactivate, sympathetic is activate. So in an under-recovered state, you don't have the ability to receive that signal in an optimal way. So flow state in those moments are really difficult. If we kind of keep coming back to this concept of being able to get to this point where you're really in the zone and you can perform and focus and concentrate and you have this, ability to really, sense your environment and you have heightened awareness, like it's probably pretty difficult to do that if your autonomic nervous system is compromised in some way, right? So I guess the way to control that is to understand the factors that influence your autonomic nervous system, right? And that's what I'm kind of getting to. If we don't understand the factors that influence, then how do we actually take control of our performance levels?
Right.
So that's kind of how I think about adaptive capacity. And of course, heart rate variability is the measure of adaptive capacity or your recovery. It's how we think about it in WHOOP terms.
Right. Okay. That clarifies a lot, but let me ask you this as a follow-up question. When I think of my own personal experiences with flow state, I think of probably the biggest games of my life that I played, and I'm sure maybe it's similar to you, or I think of really important tests that you're studying for, really important papers. And then you're also sharing examples of, let's say you have a surgeon that is a high stress situation. You have the professional athletes that you work with, you have military professionals. A lot of these are high stress situations. So that may be, at least perhaps anecdotally or subjectively, where flow state is easiest to tap into. So what I am wondering then is some sort of arousal necessary as a precursor to get into flow state? But at the same time, we take your perspective of the idea that you can make intentional choices to set yourself up for success and to give yourself the opportunity to get into the flow state, do you really need to have some sort of arousal to get in? Or can you, through those intentional choices, activate and engage in that flow state really at any time, any circumstance?
Yeah, the task still has to be relevant to you, right? To get into the flow state. So there's appraisal and relevancy that kind of work in tandem that influence arousal levels. So you can be, really well slept. You can be eating exactly what you need to eat. You can be hydrated. You can be, dealing with good psychological status, but still not get the arousal level that you need to perform the task at a level that you know, allows you to be in this flow state. So relevancy is really important. So how much does the task actually matter to me? And to what degree does it matter to me? Your relevancy creates a ceiling on energy production. And this is really important for coaches to understand too. Like, you can have an athlete who, you know, on your team who, it just doesn't matter enough, right? So they could be super talented, they could do everything right, but they just don't care enough, right? So that is going to put a ceiling on their energy production, right? But we kind of forget that that dynamic exists. The other piece that's really important, so does it matter to you? You know, how much do you actually value the task? Now, you can also really value the task, but perceive the task as beyond your capacity, beyond your capabilities. Right. So in those moments where you have, gosh, this task really matters to me, but you know what? I don't feel like I have the skills and resources to execute. You're going to not have the motivation or arousal level that enables you to execute that task at a level that, you know, is at you know, to your potential. Right. Mm-hmm. So relevancy and appraisal really work together to kind of set a ceiling on energy production and motivation.
Okay. That's something I had never thought about that. But that way.
To me, and that is the single reason why I think that is one of the primary reasons we're able to win championship, you know, 12 championships in 13 years, is because as a coach, I understood that dynamic. And that's why we only lost 4 games where I think in 13 years that we should have won, is because I controlled for this dynamic within my team. So I made sure my athletes had the skills and resources, and I made sure that they always had relevancy. Every single drill that we did in our training environment for the 13 years that I was a head coach, they understood why they were doing it. They understood why it was relevant to them. So they always had this connection, right, to why they were doing what they were doing. So that increases their arousal level, and they combine that with having skills and resources. So you have appraisal, you know, you can appraise that the task is challenging, right? Just a little bit beyond your capability. So it's exciting to you. Okay. But then you also, underpinning that, you, it's relevant to you, right? You put that together and you get fucking quality, right? Like, quality every single time you step on the field, every time you step into your craft, when you have these two and you can understand how to manipulate them, you get quality, right? And, you know, you go into a game, for example, and you've got an athlete who, you play a team who you know you're going to win. You're just more talented than they are, right? You're going to win the game by a lot, right? So your star player on your team or whatever is like, ugh, you know, I can just go and half-ass. Well, that's when you, those are trap games, right? Because the arousal level of the athlete, their mental, physical, and emotional arousal level, and their appraisal, right, that how they're appraising the task doesn't get their arousal level to a point where they can meet the energy demand that they need in order to perform to their potential. Now, they might be still so talented that they can get away with it, but they're not going to actually get better in that game. Right. So anyway, this is a dynamic we thought a lot about. We never talked about the score. It was always 0-0. You know, we had some strategic and some tactical things around, where we're at in different phases of the game. But literally, we were trying to impose our will on the opposition 100% of the time. It didn't matter if it was, you know, 10-0, 20-0, or we were down a goal. Like, we were always trying to impose our will. So, and what that does is that influences arousal levels, right? So you immediately create a task orientation that produces a relevancy that immediately speaks to the athlete in the moment that enables them to kind of control for those parameters.
Wow, that was incredible. So it's clear that this has been a massive part of your life, going back to your playing days, I would assume. So you definitely would have been, in many ways, probably pioneering this approach to coaching, because I don't think I've had a lot of experience with it. I don't think it's really become mainstream. I know that now the work that you have done and the work that Whoop is doing, we are slowly making that shift, but it's incredible to see the link between, there's so many little pieces that came to my mind there, because we start talking with flow state and arousal, and we're talking about the physiology of human behavior, but then you are starting to tie in values. And I just had, as a recent guest, I had a retired Rear Admiral in the U.S. Coast Guard Reserve, and he was president of military university for 28 years. And he was talking about leadership and empowering people to be better. And in many ways, and just in different words, that's similar to what you're saying, because you are giving someone the reason to behave, and you are empowering your athletes and your players with the values and the reason why are we doing this drill today? Why are we coming into this game? So why can we play? But then at the same time, another thing that I started thinking about is I've really big into the idea of growth mindset and Carol Dweck and her work. Mm-hmm. And the idea that it doesn't matter if it's 10-0 or 20-0 or 0-20, whatever the score is, your objective is how in this moment do we get better and how in this moment do we execute, and results are irrelevant. It's strictly dialed in. And then as I heard just kind of your passion and your energy, I kept in my mind, I was thinking of the mama mentality and Kobe Bryant. And I think of this must have been what was going through Kobe's mind when he would put up 81 or when he would just dominate, right? But that is really the difference, because very few people will either think like that or perhaps have the commitment and dedication to get there. Or, and this is where Whoop comes in and where what you are doing comes in, they may not have the tools or resources to reverse engineer that and to figure that out and to fill in the blanks, because obviously you spent your whole life not just studying this, but experiencing it and living it. And so you are a great person to talk about that. So let's now go into Whoop and let's talk about what are some of these ways that you can intentionally manifest that flow state and that performance and that consistent output of excellence in all situations.
Yeah, I think it starts, you know, kind of the moment you wake up. I think there's an opportunity to, you know, get your biological system kind of firing on all cylinders. And I think when we talk about performance, and, you know, this is always a little bit of a pet peeve, is that we talk about kind of these concepts of optimization, but there's really, you know, all the things that we need to do to perform optimally are free, right? Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of understanding what those things are and then having the discipline to do them every day. And one of the, you know, a few of the core things are just around making sure that we're, you know, aligning our internal clocks to the external environment. You know, these cueing mechanisms have such a profound influence on our ability to mentally and physically perform at our highest level, because these daytime behaviors around circadian alignment influence the quality of sleep at night, and how we sleep at night influences our ability to show up next day with capacity. So if we're interested in any sort of flow state whatsoever, we have to go through, you know, the phases of sleep, you know, at night. So nocturnal sleep is really important. We need to go through these phases of sleep and set ourselves up with our behaviors during the day, so we enable that mental, you know, and physical restoration, so we can again show up with capacity the next day and have this opportunity to experience, you know, our best self and, you know, be able to contribute to society in a way that, you know, enables us to live our values with as much energy and joy as possible, right? Because I think at a foundational level, that's what we're all about. So waking up and getting that cortisol pulse is really important. And so within 20 minutes of waking up, you want to get outside and view the natural, you know, the sky. You know, and you don't have to do it, you know, just a couple minutes, 3 minutes. But what that does is that basically tells your system that it's time to be awake, it's time to roll. And that has this incredible downstream effect and influences every cell in your body. And every cell in your body has a clock, right? So just getting outside and viewing, you know, the low solar angle. So generally speaking, within 20 minutes of waking up, before 9 a.m., you want to get outside and get your eyeballs on the natural light.
Okay. And can I just interrupt for one quick second?
Yes.
So what if you are a super early morning riser and let's say it's the dead of winter, let's say sunrise isn't until 8:30 and you go outside, you wake up at 5, you go outside at 5:15, there's going to be different light available. Is that still going to have the same benefits, or is it going to be a little bit of a sliding scale of how that may trigger your system based on the light that's available at the time of your wake up?
Yeah. So if you wake up and it's not light out yet, just bathe yourself in artificial light. It's not as good, but that will wake up your system and we'll get that cortisol going. And then as soon as the sun does get up, you know, does start to rise, go ahead and get outside. You know, that natural light is really important. The artificial light will kind of have a similar effect, but it's not as powerful, but it will get your clocks going.
Right. So optimally get the sunlight. So I love that we transitioned here into circadian biology. And this is obviously something that you've been an expert in. So everything from, like you're saying, getting the light to wake yourself up, you're talking about getting cortisol levels. We can then even talk about your melatonin cycle as in terms of the pre-bed routine. But are there some things that you think are super, super important. And, you know, actually another one that just comes to my mind is understanding timing of meals. And I have tried to do a lot of research, and I even scoured a bunch of PubMed articles, and I wasn't able to really find answers to the questions I had about how meal timing affects your circadian clock. So anecdotally, I have found that when I stop eating earlier in the day, like I'm, you know, 5, 6, 7 hours even before bed, I sleep a lot better and I have better recovery metrics. If I eat within 2 to 3 hours, I definitely get hampered, but I have had a hard time connecting those dots. So maybe you could help me out here.
Yeah. So there's two things there. So definitely we see this en masse on the platform, and just in my 5 years of just being inside folks' data and understand their behaviors, understanding meal timing, and how that influences, you know, recovery and sleep architecture. There is no question that meals within, you know, inside 2 hours of when you intend to sleep will have a deleterious effect on your sleep architecture, generally speaking. And you'll have, you know, your metrics will be, you know, won't be as good as if you stop eating a few hours before you intend to sleep. Because what's happening physiologically, and there's lots of, you know, literature to kind of support this, is that digestion is super effortful, right? Like it takes a lot of effort to digest. So it's really difficult to divert in it, and your body will prioritize digestion over recovery, right? So the recovery and rejuvenation that needs to happen during sleep can't really happen if you're also asking your system to digest. It's very difficult to do the two things at once. So basically you have to get through digestion before your body can then start to focus on repairing muscle and, you know, memory consolidation and releasing toxins from the brain and all the things that it wants to do during sleep. Right. It can't do that until it's gone through all the effortful process of digestion, because both are parasympathetic activities, right? So it all goes back to your autonomic nervous system and what you're asking your body to do. And I think that is the principle that we need to consider as it relates to meals is, you know, and I look at everything through the lens of the nervous system, but, you know, it's your activity, your fueling behavior, your activity requirements should drive your fueling behavior. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you want to digest, right, if you want to be in a position where you want to digest, which is again, a parasympathetic activity, that's when you want to have your proteins, for example. If you need, you know, available energy right away to go crush a weight session, we probably want to have like a carbohydrate, you know, rice with honey, you know, something like that. Right. So and I think as it relates to your circadian rhythm, the timing, your body is always anticipating what's next. So where I think, you know, meal timing can be important is that, you know, your body is going to start, if you eat at regular intervals, your body is going to start to anticipate that meal timing, and your body loves regularity. So there is, I think, something to be said for regular intervals of eating. And then I think, as you said, you know, as you suggest, and you've seen in your data and what we've seen in our data, and I think there's enough literature to support that, you know, stopping your timing, your eating a few hours before bedtime is definitely, I think, a path to, you know, better sleep, and, you know, more time in these deeper stages, restorative stages of sleep, which will then, I think, you know, position you to have, you know, the most possible capacity the next day.
Right. I love that. And you know what, actually before this call, I looked at some of my Whoop data from the last year and some of the trends. And I will point out that I noticed that on days that I reported having a late meal, I did notice a negative 8% in my total recovery, which I know 8% doesn't sound like a large amount, but that is a significant amount.
No, that's, really. That's so meaningful. Yeah, statistically. Yeah.
It's meaningful data. Another one I noticed on days where I reported having high stress, and again, it's subjective, so it's a little bit tough, but days I would say, yes, I was higher stress. I was, again, negative 8% in my recovery. A couple interesting ones I noted on days that I reported reading in bed, so before I went to sleep, I typically had a plus 12% in my total recovery, which was awesome. And I think, you know, maybe there's some more science I can get even your thoughts on that. And then the other one I wanted to bring up as well is on days that I reported being hydrated, which is most of the time, because I think I do a pretty good job on hydrating. So really, maybe I should look at it the other way on days I wasn't hydrated. But on days I was hydrated, my recovery was 17% higher than days I wasn't hydrated. Now, I think there's probably only a finite number of examples of days where I knew for a fact, okay, I did not hydrate well today.
Yeah.
And those days saw a huge drop. And that's a difference of, you know, 17% recovery, 9 on my HRV, and 21 minutes of REM. So those are pretty significant. But you have the luxury of observing and interacting with massive, massive amounts of data, way more than as one single person. I'm just one little blip as a data point. I'm basically irrelevant, but you have the luxury of millions of data points. So what do you think are a few of the biggest trends that you've seen through the Whoop Journal and through those other measures that have that drive the most value for people in trying to set themselves up for optimal capacity the next day?
Meal timing is, there's no question. Meal timing is just such a profound behavior. Just really doing everything you can to, you know, kind of have your last bite of food, you know, 2 to 3 hours before you intend to sleep is really powerful. I mean, the other piece that's huge is, you know, exposure to blue light before bed, you know, is gonna influence your ability to fall asleep, you know, your sleep onset latency. And even if you're tired enough where you fall asleep, it will end up fragmenting your sleep. You're not going to spend as much time in these deeper stages of sleep. You know, and there's obviously plenty of literature around that. So, you know, just again, like being really aware of how you're exposing yourself to light after the sun goes down, frankly. I mean, that's kind of the second piece to the, you know, when we think about circadian alignment and how, you know, we view the sun in the morning, kind of how that sets us up for our, you know, as we build pressure, you know, sleep pressure throughout the day. And when we finally release that melatonin, like all of that is really synchronized, right? By the timing of when we wake up, and we want to, really make sure that we kind of succumb to that natural pressure for sleep. That's very much, you know, set by when we wake up in the morning, and we want to make that again as regular as possible. The other thing that can compromise that sleep pressure is exposure to bright lights, you know, after the sun goes down. So one of the best things you can tell your system that, hey, it's time to wind down, is actually to watch the sunset during that time, where the angle of the sun is low and you've got that blue and yellow hue, as it's going down. Even if it's cloudy out, you know, still you're going to be sending signals to your body that it's time to wind down. The other, and then once you get into your home environment, making sure the lights are really dim. You know, the more exposure you have to blue light, to artificial light, you know, that will definitely influence your sleep and then, you know, your recovery metrics, as a result. So artificial light exposure, meal timing, you said hydration, no question. Like if you go to bed dehydrated, your heart rate variability is just crushed, you know? And we definitely see this with, you know, professional athletes, you know, who might end up, you know, drinking alcohol on a plane or, you know, traveling across the country. I mean, all of these, you know, or, you know, a big night out after a collegiate game or something, you know, like,
yeah,
you know, there's just been a lot of moments where folks are really dehydrated, or during preseason when just, you know, people are sweating a ton, it's really, really hard to get enough fluids on board. But yeah, all of those kind of work together to, and really do compromise recovery. Yeah.
Okay. That's a great review. And I'm glad that you brought up alcohol, because I know I saw a Whoop study that you guys did, which I think it must've been at least 20,000 sleeps or something. And it was on alcohol. And it was one of the ones that you talked about, and it was impaired recovery up to 5 days after, and almost, you know, 80%+ within the first 24, 48 hours where you have impaired recovery and you have impaired sleep. And it really makes you question what is the value in that alcohol and just how detrimental something like that could be. Because really my understanding of it is what the alcohol is doing is it is affecting your clock. And so it is affecting your hormones and the way your body is supposed to function on all these physiological processes. So it's not like it's just some necessarily some crazy poison that's coming in and just turning everything off, but it is in many ways, it's switching off the cycles that need to happen. And therefore it prevents your performance. Now, the other thing you said is, let's say someone has jet lag because they're traveling. You talk about, perhaps we're talking about CEOs or professional athletes, people that are flying a lot, or in some cases, someone like you who is flying from Boston to Alaska. And jet lag is super, super hard for people. And I was listening to Dr. Andrew Huberman's podcast, which he had some wonderful stuff about this. And this is something that I don't really know as much about. I understand that there are challenges with your circadian clock and how it gets shifted. Yeah. But I know a point that he mentioned, and I mentioned this to you just before we got on the phone, was that it is easier to travel west than it is to travel east. And just to kind of quickly paraphrase what he was talking about in his podcast, which people should listen to because he's brilliant, is so the idea that it's easier for your body to force itself to stay awake longer than normal than it is to force itself to go to sleep. So if you're traveling west to east and the time becomes later and you say, well, I got to go to bed at 8 p.m. because I normally go to bed at 8 p.m., for example, but that's your circadian clock is thinking, it's still 5 p.m. here. Like, I'm not ready to go to bed. That's a lot harder. Yeah. So I'd love for you to just share this little bit. And also, just for the people that are listening, you just traveled, you did your 3 hours, you stayed on your Eastern time zone the entire time. So you didn't adjust your clock. And I know you've done that with some of your teams before, and you've been a big proponent of doing that. And I would love for you to share your personal experiences and some of the science of jet lag, circadian clock, and why this is so important.
Yeah. So you can opt out of jet lag. There's no question. and it's really just by manipulating light, manipulating mealtime, manipulating exercise in combination with meal timing and light exposure is a really powerful combination that can kind of amplify, you know, one and the other. And it creates some really cool mechanistic biological influences that really accelerate or amplify the kind of what's happening with your clocks. And then I would say sleep-wake timing obviously is really critical. And we didn't actually, you know, from a behavior standpoint, when we talk about recovery metrics, that actually is the most important behavior is your sleep time and your rise time.
Right.
And we did a study when you're talking about large data sets, I mean, holy cow. I mean, we have millions of sleeps, right? And the signature, the one thing that we see in our data as being the most influential on resilience, and, you know, as measured through our, you know, physiological, you know, data, is sleep-wake timing.
Amazing.
So I know you're going to, you know, you asked me at the end, the most important behavior, as it relates to high performance and health. And it is literally stabilizing your sleep and rise time.
It's amazing.
And then, you know, combining that with, you know, watching the sunset, watching the sun, you know, that lower solar angle, you know, those are just they're just core behaviors. So really, if you want to opt out of jet lag, you want to try to keep, you know, the light mealtime, exercise, sleep, wake time on your home time zone. That's really the best way to do it. And, you know, I do this experiment when I travel all the time, and it can be a little inconvenient, and sometimes it's not possible given, you know, work demands and schedules. But I was fortunate enough to be able to actually do that when I was in Alaska. And, you know, you saw my data. It was literally, I was in a taper phase too. So there, you know, there's that. I was coming off of a really hard training block and used and knew in Alaska, I wouldn't have as much time to, you know, to work out. So I kind of just did, you know, some HIIT stuff in the hotel room and did some walking and stuff, but I was in a taper. So there was that effect as well, but literally was green the entire time. Right. So
amazing.
It was a combination, you know, I was doing work that I really love and that I'm really passionate about. So, you know, I had a lot of purpose. I was with, you know, a few of my teammates at Whoop who I adore and was spending great social time with them. And then I went to bed, you know, and woke up exactly when I went go to bed and wake up on the East Coast. I kept my meal times really stable. I ate very cleanly, stayed super hydrated. I brought a little happy lamp with me. So, you know, right at 3:30 in the morning, Alaska time, you know, which was, 7:30 East Coast time, you know, I exposed myself to a bunch of bright light. But yeah. And then when I got home from my Alaska trip, I was just literally, you know, just still firing on cylinders.
that's absolutely amazing. So then to follow up, daylight savings time, do you stick to one time year round if you can? Or I know there are people that will try and transition that hour and adjust their cycle over a period of maybe 2 weeks or so, where they'll incrementally, you know, maybe 5 minutes a day, wake up a little bit earlier, a little bit later. What are your thoughts on that? Because even just 1 hour can have a big impact as well.
Yeah, it really can. Like, you know, where our systems, you know, are actually, you know, quite sensitive to these small perturbations, right? And we see that in the data. I definitely try to like just kind of back into it, ease into it. And, you know, I think if you're, you know, younger and healthy and, you know, it's not as big of a deal, but as you get older, you know, and your systems may be a bit more vulnerable, I think it's worthwhile kind of taking some of these precautions, you know, and being a little bit more thoughtful about, you know, easing into these moments where there's going to be time changes and really thinking, you know, critically about, you know, travel and how your system's going to be able to handle that, and doing whatever you can to make sure that you're, you know, mitigating some of these, you know, negative physiological effects that you know will inevitably occur when, you know, you're traveling and changing time zones, and, you know, so just really, you know, staying off alcohol, you know, just hydrating, like eating really cleanly.
So no alcohol on your first class flights.
I know, right?
While watching the movies there, that's a triple whammy there. That's a bad recipe.
Yeah, that's just this layering on, you know, it's just really hard for your system already. You ask it then, you know, to go ahead and digest, you know, alcohol, it's just a lot to ask of your system. Yeah.
But I would like to remind people that a lot of the advice that you're giving, well, essentially all of it is free. I mean, obviously there are some inherent costs in doing some things, but this is free. And these are intentional choices that you can make to act this way. And then therefore be able to be more resilient, which is a word that you brought up. And this ties in directly with your PhD. So this is where I want to take this conversation next. So I would love for you to share basically a rundown of what it is you're studying and why. But just before you do that, how do you define resilience? And then how do you relate resilience to physiology or to actual data that you can measure? Because that's something that I was trying to figure that out for myself, and I don't know how I would approach that.
Resilience is your capacity to adapt functionally to demands.
Okay.
And that's kind of my own, that's how I think about it. Like if you have the capacity to adapt to whatever external stress comes your way in a way that you kind of in, you know, if you have an external stress, you know, and you're presented with that external stress and you have the capacity to adapt to that stress in a way that you feel good about, like to me, that's resilience, you know, if you can do that kind of over time. And then there's like the resilience of just, and if you have the capacity to adapt, that then implies you have, you know, your immune system is in a good spot. You know, I haven't been sick in 4 years, right? I'm super resilient human, right? Like, I think, especially in these times, you know, we think about COVID and, you know, your capacity kind of to adapt functionally to your environment is really important, right? And in order to kind of do that, you can keep track of markers like heart rate variability. And that's where I feel like, you know, you can keep track of, you know, the quality and, you know, consistency of your sleep. So I think tracking your sleep is really core if you want to understand, you know, resilience, get to a point where you can become the most resilient human possible, one that is able to adapt effectively to one's environment. You know, there are some things that you can kind of measure and track that I think are really important. And that's kind of one piece of the PhD is actually looking at physiological feedback on measures of resilience. So just using WHOOP. So the PhD is basically the impact of circadian alignment, autonomic control, and physiological feedback on measures of resilience. And we're basically looking at, so everyone, all 1,000 folks get a WHOOP in the study. One group, and they're all told sleep is important. One group gets an intervention of cold, dark, quiet. So room hygiene, which is kind of the gold standard in terms of advice that you give to help someone sleep better. So obviously really important, cold room, a dark room, a quiet room. The other group is getting intervention. So a third of the group's getting a circadian alignment intervention where they're encouraged to think about their meal timing. So they'll be instructed to stop eating 2 to 3 hours prior to when they intend to sleep. Light exposure, watching the sky, you know, getting 2 minutes of outdoor light in the morning, watching the sky transition. And stabilizing when they go to bed and when they wake up. So that's their circadian alignment. They've got the cold, dark, quiet. And then the other group is just simply wearing WHOOP. They know that sleep is important. They've been told sleep is important, but they're just literally wearing the device. So we'll be able to see kind of just WHOOP on its own, as we've seen across the, you know, hundreds of thousands of folks who were on the platform, is that we modify behavior, right? We like just seeing your data and being exposed to your data and the elegance that is Whoop in terms of how we deliver data and feedback, we modify behavior. And we've been able to prove this, but this is just a cool study of 1,000 folks in a controlled environment where we'll be able to really validate this this concept of behavior change on the platform. And then, but in addition to Whoop, when we layer on this intervention, you know, what does that effect have on measures of resilience? And we measure resilience by, you know, changes in heart rate variability, you know, increases in heart rate variability, reductions in resting heart rate. So we'll be able to look at this across all three groups.
Right. Okay. So many of the metrics then that you are evaluating are going to be similar to what constitutes the recovery score that Whoop generates.
So yeah, so we have all the physiological data, and then they were given a robust resilience questionnaire in the beginning. So a 15-minute survey that gives a baseline understanding of their level of resilience going into the study. So over the course of the study, and they'll take this, you know, at the end of the study, at the end of May, they'll retake the resilience questionnaire, and we'll be able to see, you know, did they improve resilience over the course of the study? And then what happened physiologically? And is there a relationship between subjective measures of resilience and the physiological metrics that we're tracking? You know, and what does it look like across these three groups? The whole goal is to provide a playbook, you know, to the U.S. Army in a place where they really struggle with mental health and suicide, you know, to provide a playbook. Hey, if we can do cold, dark, quiet, if we can do circadian alignment, and if we have, you know, this physiological kind of monitoring and feedback loop, and we combine all these together, you know, can we improve resilience in a group that really, you know, really struggles with some of these elements.
So since you're a researcher, obviously, and you're doing a ton of high level stuff, this is a question that I've always thought a lot about, not as someone doing the research, but as someone reading a lot of research. And that is the idea of causation versus correlation. Mm-hmm. So obviously you need to have significant amount of data points to begin to identify. And, you know, there's always the classic arguments that everyone makes when they bicker back and forth about who's right and who's wrong. It's like, oh, it was an epidemiology study. But so do you find it challenging in situations like this? Because there are so many different factors. Now, you have the luxury of you have 1,000 people, and I would assume that this study is going to last a pretty long time. So you're going to accumulate a ton of data points.
But so much data, yeah.
How do you navigate those challenges and try and really isolate single driving factors and say, you know what, we really do believe that, I mean, you can get down to the minutia and saying sleeping in a room that's 64 degrees Fahrenheit, which I think is where you said you set your room temperature to, opposed to 67 or 68 Fahrenheit. Yeah. You know, it gets really hard. I think maybe it's unfair to expect that we could have a complete, you know, algebraic equations where we can say this equates this, because it's nothing is that simple and there's a lot of factors. But is that a challenge that you really have to try and navigate?
There, no question. You know, I mean, that's what makes research really, really hard. You know, and we did try to build in, you know, they get a survey at night, they get, you know, just a 30-second survey that, you know, in the morning that, you know, ask them very quickly if they're able to do the intervention. And what degree they were able to do the intervention. And they've been told, hey, we know that not every day you're going to be able to do the intervention, but we'll know whether or not they were able to do it reasonably well. And there's no pressure to do it when, you know, and the variability isn't a bad thing, right? We will be able to statistically account for all of that and be able to say something, I think, pretty cool about it. But yeah, so I think, you know, in this study, I think the opportunity is we'll be able to say something statistically meaningful about these three interventions and how they, you know, how they contribute to resilience. So it's, you know, it's, and we, you know, we've been able to, you know, we did a social desirability questionnaire at the beginning, like basically, you know, who's more prone to bullshit versus others. You know, either we really thought about this, like,
absolutely.
So yeah, we, you know, there's way to your point, like there's ways that you can increase rigor, right, by incorporating some of these measures that help you understand or contextualize some of the data and help you interpret it in a way that you know, is not misleading or, you know, enables you to really either say something or not, you know, and be able to call that out.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, I know that you guys are going to be incredibly thorough and everyone that puts out research is, but it is definitely one of those topics where
but they
it's
all,
difficult
you know, not
to.
All research is rigorous, you know, like to be fair, you know, like, you know, some of it is, but yeah, I think just the sheer number and the amount of data that we're collecting is, you know, it's, and I think that's, you know, one of the great opportunities with Whoop is that, you know, we have this, you know, very few studies, certainly on the psychological side, have physiological data. Mm. And I think that is always, you know, frankly, one of the reasons why I joined Whoop, honestly, is, you know, my background is in my academic background is in psychology. And, you know, I've done just in my years at Princeton, you know, a lot of work in the exercise physiology area and just doing my own programming and all that. But, you know, I think there's just a huge opportunity in the field of psychology to contextualize psychological data by understanding what does the person's sleep look like, how you can even say something about someone's psychological status without understanding someone's sleep architecture. To me is like, I don't even know that. I'm not even interested in thinking about that. Like, right. I feel like you have to have the physiological in order to understand the psychological and vice versa. Like, I just think having one without the other is just a complete miss. Not that I want to dismiss any research that's been done without one of the others, but I just feel like it just enriches the data and what you can actually say is going on in a way that is really the future of scientific research.
That's super interesting because I've probably neglected or been ignorant to that approach throughout most of my life. And I think probably a lot of people are, because when I, let's take the term resilience, for example, you think, oh, you just got to be tougher. It's just mental toughness. And that's what you're taught in sports growing up, or at least, you know, maybe not these days, but that's what it's always been. And
we separate the physiology from the psychology.
Right. Exactly. So we separate them. And that's what I wanted to ask you, because then a lot of people, and probably still today, probably a lot of prominent performers and leaders still probably believe that, what's the word I'm looking for? Mutually exclusive. They probably think that psychology and physiology are mutually exclusive, but you know, if you are taking a holistic systems approach to performance, you have to realize that it's more of a Venn diagram where they're going to influence each other. And so it's interesting the way you were talking about resilience, because one of the things that I was thinking about is in that study that you have is, you know, you're probably going to have a lot of people in general, people who are going to be in the Arctic warfare unit are probably more of that, you know, I don't want to just put in words that maybe don't make the right sense, but resilient people in general, in terms of, let's say, a psychology perspective.
They'll be higher on the scale.
Right. But then baseline. It's exactly, but it's just so interesting to think about how we can then start to look at someone's psychology, and some people will maybe count themselves out as just, well, I don't want to do that. Or is someone's predisposition to being perhaps not as mentally tough, whatever you want to coin that term, can that then be traced back? And I think that's amazing that we can start looking at, well, maybe it is just as simple as sleep behaviors and circadian alignment that could be the prerequisite that is leading to potential issues. I mean, it's revolutionary in what you are studying and what you are trying to bring more education and light to.
And that is where the gap in the literature is, frankly, is, you know, what is the association between bravery and courage and wisdom? And how does that actually relate to a person's sleep, right? Like, there's got to be like a pretty strong like correlation, right? Like, you know, it's really hard, I think, to, you know, grasp what's important when you're consistently under recovered or consistently not getting the sleep that you need. You know, I just feel like living your, you know, values or even identifying what it is that you really care about is difficult, you know, and I think there's moral and ethical implications, I think, that go when you're just, you know, consistently don't have the capacity to, you know, you make decisions. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the opportunity to kind of study and integrate, you know, psychology and physiology is really, it just provides, I think, an enormous opportunity to say something a bit more meaningful about what's really going on, you know, as it relates to, you know, in this case, resilience, right? Like, you know, to try to unpack resilience and not understand changes in physiology and changes in sleep architecture, I just don't know how you can really do it.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't know.
That's brilliant. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. I've already learned a lot so far in this call. And just quick, if you had to make a hypothesis of which you think would be more influential between sleep behaviors and sleep hygiene as opposed to circadian alignment. Is there one that you think, one intervention that is more likely to have a positive impact?
On the behavior side, stable sleep and wake timing, I think that's the key. It's the key to the kingdom. Like I really believe that, like that is the mother of all behaviors is really, you know, knowing when your natural pressure for sleep is. So, you know, if I not having a lot of sleep debt on board, you know, no caffeine after one, like really figuring out when is it that I naturally feel sleepy, and then setting up your routine so you can, you know, succumb to that sleep pressure consistently at the same time. Like, I think that's so powerful. And then allowing yourself to just wake up naturally so you can get into that sweet spot of how much time you actually need to spend in bed in order to fully capture that, you know, the deep sleep, that restorative, regenerative sleep that you need, and minimize the awake time. You know, like, and light sleep is really important too. So don't want to count that out, but you know, just phasing through, these sleep cycles in an optimal way is worth all of your time and energy to figure out. But, you know, kind of establishing the sleep and rise time, exposure to sunlight in the morning, you know, within 20 minutes of waking up, prior to 9 a.m., watching the sun set, dimming the lights, stopping eating before bed, you know, a couple hours before you intend to sleep, and then succumbing to that natural sleep pressure. Boom. That's it.
That's the magic recipe. I love that. So I would love for you to share just a little bit. We don't have to go in super detail about your personal routine or perhaps your personal sleep hygiene. And what are a few things that someone like yourself who lives and breathes this does so that you can put up those insane recovery scores and being in the green all the time, traveling, working, doesn't matter. What do you do?
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, my personal goal is to, you know, live my values with as much joy and energy as possible. Right. Like I want to be able to, you know, feel like I'm living with purpose and I know to do that, I need to get the best possible night's sleep. So really my daytime behaviors, I'm motivated to ensure that I do these things so I can really optimize my sleep at night so I can show up the next day with, you know, capacity, again, being able to live my values. So yeah, everything that I've talked about, I do for the most part. I try to exercise, I guess, one thing that I haven't talked about, within, you know, 30 minutes, 3 hours or 11 hours of waking up. So that's generally speaking when you're going to be optimized to perform. So like today, I went running 3 hours after I woke up, basically. And, you know, when I was commuting into Boston for work, I would wake up within 30 minutes of waking up. And I make sure you know, within 20 minutes of waking up, I definitely get outside. You know, I view the sky, get my eyeballs, you know, in the skyline. You know, so my body knows that it's time to be awake. Really careful about light after the sun goes down. So I've got, you know, filters and blue light blocking glasses. I don't use blue blocking light glasses during the day. I used to. And then as I read the literature, I was like, whoa, no, I want blue light during the day. Right, what am I doing? Right. So I think that is important for folks to note. I do know that people do experience strain from computer. So that can be a reason to, you know, kind of, but that's more of just maybe the size and less from the blue light.
It may be some people, if they spend 10 hours a day in front of a screen, it's a little different than people who have the luxury of not having to stare at screens all day. So
yes, and definitely. But yeah, so those are some of the really core behaviors. And then, you know, from a nutrition, and I'm, you know, I am not a doctor, and I'm not a nutritionist, but for me personally, like I really try to think about my fueling behavior in the context of whatever my activity requirement is. So that's really important to me. And where I feel best. You know, I try not to eat foods that are not, you know, that are inappropriate for like whatever my demand is. Sounds, I guess, pretty common sense.
but it's not though. It's not with common sense, but not commonplace perhaps.
Yeah. I don't know that people really think about that. Like I'm not going to put a lot of food in my body that I if I'm not in a position to actually digest it properly, right? So if I put a lot of protein in my body and then I need to go give a massive presentation, like I'm going to be in a sympathetic state the entire time. It's really, so again, I'm confusing the heck out of my system, right? Because I'm asking to be, I need my heart to be responsive to the sympathetic branch of my nervous system, but I need to also digest. So I need parasympathetic activation. So nothing is optimized, right? And so I think when we start to think about some of our behaviors in the context of what our, of allowing our system to do what it wants to do naturally and like creating some synergy between the behaviors and what's happening internally. Now, all of a sudden, like we're not fighting ourselves. Like, you know, we're enabling our body to do what it needs to do naturally. And I think that's kind of the path to flow and optimization, you know?
I love that. That was actually a quote I heard from Stephen Kotler. He said, peak performance is allowing your body to do what it's supposed to do instead of hindering it. Essentially. Yeah. So the body's really smart, really capable of doing things. Let's just facilitate that to work as possible. Just a quick interruption then. If you're talking about, okay, so protein is a lot harder to digest. So that's why it would require more digestion to be more parasympathetic. So then in the case where you wanted to fuel yourself or being in a sustained sympathetic state, would that mean in that case then carbohydrates, because they're easy to digest, and so that's going to be less straining and less of a conflict between systems? Is that kind of what I'm understanding?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if you're going to do a, you know, just like huge weight session, like, yeah, like, you know, some white rice, I think you know, cook it in some MCT oil, like I think white rice is easier to digest than brown rice from everything that I've read.
I've read the same thing with all the gluten and the grains and everything.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, white rice, and then Dave Asprey talked about, you know, putting some brain octane, you know, some MCT oil in, cooking it in the rice. That makes a lot of sense. I like some of the stuff that he puts out, but.
Yeah, do you do the bulletproof coffee too?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't actually drink coffee, but I love Dave Asprey. So I follow all of his stuff and incorporate what aligns with what I do, at least.
Totally. Yeah. I think he makes a lot of sense sometimes. So anyway, I think the white rice, that it's easy to digest. It's, you know, available, like, you know, you can convert it really quickly, and some honey on there. I mean, that to me, like, if I'm going to do a weight session, I have just a little bit of that just to get my system going. Again, it's not going to require a lot, you know, from my system, but will give me energy that I need, that I can use right away, for that session.
Perfect. Okay. So before I ask the final question, where can people find you? Where can they learn more about Whoop, the things you're doing, and just some great resources that you'd love to plug in? Because I'd love for people to learn more, because I've already learned a ton from you, even just from following some of your stories and posts on Instagram and LinkedIn and stuff. So
awesome. Yeah. So, Whoop.com is an awesome resource. The Locker is a place where it's like just our big knowledge center. And then, you know, Whoop Performance Optimization, you know, Whoop on LinkedIn, Whoop on Instagram, are all awesome places to see stuff. You know, I have personal nonsense on Instagram that people can follow, but, you know, most of it's, you know, pretty helpful, I think. Kristen_Holmes 2126, I think, is my Instagram handle. I just joined in February, so I'm a little new, but and then LinkedIn, I definitely like, I share a lot of research, and, you know, any kind of partnerships that we're getting into where we're going to be doing, you know, research on, you know, using Whoop 24/7 in a, you know, research on psychedelics, or, you know, we do all sorts of like kind of cool partnerships where we're looking at, you know, different types of therapies. You know, we've got, you know, we're looking at FC of certain, you know, cancer treatments, and, you know, exercise during cancer treatment, and, you know, how that influences the markers that we track and sleep architecture, and, you know, all that. So we're doing a lot of really, really cool research, frankly. And I always post about that. So,
yeah, that's amazing. Well, everything you're doing and everything Whoop is doing is at the forefront of, you know, cutting edge technology and health and wellness and the future of everything going on. And so I've been a big follower, and I will plug that another good source is the Whoop podcast. I don't know, maybe you said it, maybe you didn't even think about it, but the Whoop podcast is one of my go-to podcasts. There are so many great episodes. You can find Kristen in at least 5 or 6 of the episodes so far. I think I found 4 or 5 of you in there.
I think it's more like...
Am I way off?
Yeah.
Oh no. Okay. Well, I haven't listened to them all.
Okay. No, but so my dear friend and wonderful colleague Emily Capodilippo, our VP of Data Science and Research, she and I go on a fair amount.
Okay, I've heard you guys a few different ones, especially about sleep. I've heard.
We talk about sleep. Today's episode is about. Is with Dr. Daniel Plews, who's an exercise physiologist and is really one of the godfathers in terms of exercise and heart rate variability research. Mm. So we ask him a ton of questions and he's so insightful. So that's a really good episode that's coming out today. So Emily and I definitely jam. We talk about, you know, naps and, you know, different ways to think about recovery and, you know, how to mitigate, you know, jet lag and all of the science behind the Whoop platform.
I love it.
She and I jam on. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. So I'll make sure for people that are listening along that I will put links to everything in the show notes and on my website. And so people can find it. And I'm not supposed to say this as a podcaster, but I'd recommend that you listen. You're probably going to get more of the Whoop podcast than mine. I'm doing my best to keep up, but I fully encourage everyone to listen to the Whoop podcast because I listen to it all the time and I love it. So
yours is great. I was able to check out a couple episodes. So thanks for all the good work you're doing.
And, this is more of a passion project. It's fun. This is what I'm trying to live what I'm passionate about. And I just think this is incredible. So to wrap up, I've taken a lot of your morning here. And so we basically answered all of this already, but just for a quick summary for people to take home with that they can implement today, one piece of advice to optimize health, one piece of advice to optimize happiness, and one piece of advice to optimize performance. What would Kristen Holmes recommend?
I think it starts with the circadian alignment piece. And I know I've been just harping on that like nonstop, but you know, stabilizing sleep wake time is, you know, when we talk about this concept of just enabling your system to just fire on all cylinders and, you know, to be able to show up tomorrow with as much capacity as possible. That's really the foundation is, you know, knowing when to go to bed, knowing when to wake up, optimizing that behavior. And then that will have a downstream effect on your cardiovascular system, your metabolic system, like, you know, your immune health. Like it's crazy how much that one behavior influences resilience. And I go back to, you know, our project that we're doing with Harvard. It's called the COVID Resilience Project. And, you know, we're going to be submitting for peer review here, but, you know, again, the one behavior that we've seen, and we're not just talking about, again, you know, N of 12, we're talking about hundreds of thousands, millions of sleeps, right? And we're looking at, you know, huge, huge physiological data. Sleep-wake behavior is the number one predictor of human resilience. Wow. So I think it's, to me, that spans across, you know, health. It enables
everything.
You know, it just, gives you the keys to access happiness, to access, you know, performance levels, to access energy. It's all there.
All the sleep behaviors that you talked about today, everything about consistent wake sleep timing, that is going to be the key you need to unlock resilience and capacity to tie it back to the start, to capacity to perform and to live the life that you love and that you can enjoy and that aligns with your values to kind of make it a holistic little ending. That's brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Kristen, for taking the time. This was amazing. I absolutely loved it. I learned a ton. I'm going to keep learning from everything you're doing. I'm super excited to see all the stuff that happens in the future with Whoop and with your personal studies and everything else. So I really, really appreciate it. It's wonderful. Thank you so much again.
Well, I appreciate you having me. Thank you for the time. This is great.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
To discover more, the full transcript of this episode with all citations is available on the website, and you can also contact me on social media with any questions or comments. If you found this episode useful or think that it may help someone else, I encourage you to pass it along. Thank you all for joining me on this journey to lifelong health, happiness, and higher performance. And remember, always be grateful, love yourself, and serve others.